So this is what I'm presenting on. Benefit sharing arrangements and material transfer agreements in international collaborative research. I have nothing to disclose. And although this project grew out of an effort conducted while I was at the NIH Clinical Center's Department of Bioethics, the opinions are mine and mine only. So what brings us here today? Well, we argue that research in developing nations operates under an essentially fair exchange model. Obviously, there are huge health disparities and inequalities, but the potential for inequity is substantially increased in international collaborative research. And there are a number of reasons for that. That includes the fact that a substantial amount of research doesn't focus on the health concerns that take place in developing nations. In other instances, research products are priced out of the reach of healthcare systems. And even when they are affordable, oftentimes there isn't the personnel or infrastructure to implement those interventions. Finally, a lack of internal funding and technology means that communities can't address research efforts to address their own needs and priorities. So I'm going to describe two cases that demonstrate this problem, and also look at the guidelines and conventions that have put in place to help reduce the potential for exploitation and why we think they simply aren't enough. Finally, I'll present our framework, which has both a process and a set of interrelated products in the form of material transfer agreements and benefit sharing arrangements. And for those of you who may not be familiar with material transfer agreements, they're generally used to govern the transfer and storage of samples that can be between institutions or across international lines as well. So one of the first cases that really led us to be interested in this began in 2006 when Indonesia started withholding flu virus samples from the WHO's Global Influenza Surveillance Network. And as you probably remember, this was, you know, kind of at the peak of the avian influenza epidemic, and so it led to a great deal of concern. Indonesia argued that there was a patent filed on a flu vaccine by an Australian company, and that really pointed to deeper inequities in the system, in which developing nations provided samples and data to the network. It was then transferred at no cost to pharmaceutical companies generally located in the developed world, and the products that resulted were priced out of the reach of those developing nations. So they tried to address this through a number of World Health Assembly meetings. In fact, they discussed it at the last meeting of the WHA in May of this year, and they proposed two potential solutions. So the first was granting WHO a royalty-free, non-exclusive, and transferable license for any products that grew out of the network. And the second was a clause that calls for the participation of scientists from originating laboratories in countries, both in scientific presentations and in publications. These are still under contention, and they're meeting to discuss it at the next World Health Assembly meeting in May. The second case grew out of a long-standing collaboration between Oxford University and the University of Nairobi, and they were looking at natural immunity to HIV among sex workers in Nairobi and also in other parts of Africa. In 1999, the British Medical Research Council, which was funding this project, filed a patent on a number of the HIV sequences, and they only listed the names of two of the Oxford researchers. So obviously this led to a great deal of concern among the other members of the research team, and also an outcry in the Kenyan press. And they worked to create a new memorandum of understanding that addressed things like scientific credit, intellectual property rights, and also the benefits that should accrue both to members of the research team and also to Kenyans as a whole. So in light of this problem, we wanted to see if there were guidelines and conventions that were in place to help avoid situations like the two I just described. We conducted a comprehensive review of these guidelines and analyzed a total of 11 in depth. And out of that, we really found two that seemed to apply. The first was the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was first adopted in 1993 and then later enshrined in the form of the Bond Guidelines in 2002. It does specifically exclude human genetic material, but there are a number of features of it that make it a good model. So they call for community consultation and consideration at multiple points, particularly in the development of policies, and they call for a wide range of benefits, so monetary benefits, non-monetary benefits that relate to R&D, and also a broader set of benefits in the form of increasing access to employment opportunities, providing social recognition for communities, and also developing sustained professional relationships. The second set of guidelines grew out of this in part, and it was issued by the Human Genome Organization in 2000. They were really driven by the notion of three forms of justice: compensatory justice, procedural justice, and distributive justice. And they recommend community consultation as a means of achieving procedural justice. Their benefits focus primarily on health, and they include technology transfer, infrastructure improvements, things of that nature. And they also pay attention to the level of benefits, calling for 1 to 3% of post-tax profits to go toward things of that type. So we argue that even if the CBD didn't exclude human genetic material, it would be a poor fit for a number of reasons. And perhaps the most important is that it doesn't differentiate between research taking place in low and middle income countries and high income countries. In part because it's based on the idea of national sovereignty. They also call for national level consultation and don't really drill down to the level of the community. Hugo is a better fit, obviously. It was developed with biomedical research in mind, but the actual process used to engage communities is very vague. It applies to a very limited set of researchers, and even then is only voluntary, and they don't clearly define beneficiaries or address issues of collaboration. So we argue that this limited amount of guidance really hinders the development of research efforts. It increases the burden on research ethics committees and IRBs. It reduces the likelihood that communities benefit from their participation in research. And it also means that developing nation researchers may not be able to create efforts that align with their own interests. So we've developed a basic framework that can be used by researchers themselves, funding agencies, academic institutions to help address some of these problems. So the first step in that was really defining who would be involved in this consultative process. And we defined that group of stakeholders fairly broadly as everyone who would be affected by the decision to conduct research in a particular setting. As I mentioned, Hugo looks at procedural, compensatory, and distributive justice, and we really look only at procedural and compensatory, seeing distributive justice as simply too broad to ground a requirement, and also something that applies to everyone, not just researchers. We describe the consultative process in great detail because it's not mentioned in those other documents. And we call for expanding MTAs to address other issues of importance, both for the research team members, so that would be things like IP, patenting, the use of stored samples, and also items relevant to the broader community, both in the terms of the benefits that would be provided and also the dissemination of results and acknowledgement or attribution in publications. So one reason that the process isn't described in those guidance documents is there's really no standard definition of what constitutes a fair process. There are a number of themes that arise in the literature, and you can see those on the screen. We used those and developed a four-stage process. And those stages are the initial stakeholder consultation, the negotiation and drafting of agreements, the central research effort itself, and post-trial contact and communication. And one thing to keep in mind is that the participants in each stage are slightly different, but the stages are all interrelated and inform each other. So during the first stage, one of the biggest challenges is really deciding who should be involved and ensuring that there's broad and equitable representation from members of the stakeholder groups. We believe that research team members, both local and foreign, should be involved from the beginning, and that they will kind of lay the foundation for the rest of the process. They'll focus on those issues I described, data sharing, IP, authorship. The next set of stakeholders are healthcare professionals or other staff who will actually carry out the research effort. And their focus is a little different. They'll look at the impact of the research effort on their organization's overall functioning and also on the health and well-being of residents in the community as a whole. They help identify needs in the organization and the community at large and also prioritize the benefits. And finally, they do determine specific components of the material transfer process, so how samples will be stored, who will be responsible for shipping things. Finally, we call for involving potential research participants and also other community representatives. And community consultation of that type is found to have a number of benefits and is used in much of the guidance that's currently available. And those individuals will focus on the nature of the benefit sharing agreement and also participant recruitment, informed consent, the dissemination of findings and the like. So as I said, one important thing is really making that the representatives at the table are viewed as legitimate representatives by the members of the groups. And so we call for using a wide array of strategies to recruit participants. And those include reaching out to individuals who provide health advice and assistance, partnering with respected local organizations, or using techniques such as snowball sampling to identify opinion leaders. Again, because there is the question of who should represent groups and what makes someone a legitimate representative, we think it's really important to document this. So if problems arise later on, you have the justification for why these individuals were selected. So this stage has very concrete goals. You need to draft and secure agreement on the MTAs and benefit sharing arrangements. Again, there's a smaller set of representatives at this stage, but the concern about making sure that those representatives are legitimate still remains. And finally, you need to make sure that, again, how conflicts will be arbitrated and what responsibilities the individuals who sign these documents will have takes place. So once the research effort begins, we really think that you begin to see some of the benefits of engaging in this consultative process. So those include increased trust with key stakeholders and the support of healthcare professionals, indigenous leaders, and other CBOs who might advance your outreach and recruitment efforts. Some of the specific benefits may start to be provided at this stage, depending on what those were. So if training was identified and prioritized, you would need to provide opportunities for trainees to be involved or at least observe some of the research effort. There may also be things such as presentations to lay people on the health concern of interest, networking events for foreign scientists and in-country researchers, or discussions with health service providers. In addition, this is really the point where you need to develop a plan for how any resources that are used in the research process are going to be used in the future. So, as we all know, research is not always a known process, and it may or may not result in a viable test or treatment. So with that in mind, we think it's very important to maintain contact with all of the stakeholders and, of course, the research participants. Special attention needs to be paid to how null results or the decision to terminate a research effort will be shared with all of the parties, and they also need to be offered updates on any plans for commercialization or patenting of end products. Keeping these channels open would also allow you to engage in a limited stakeholder process if, by the time a product, test, or treatment becomes available, the needs that they had prioritized no longer match the concerns of their community. So obviously, some of the beneficiaries will be representatives of those stakeholder groups I described earlier. But we do believe that certain individuals or groups may be due additional benefits than others. And that would be based either on their contribution to the research effort or on the burden borne by their research participation. Even though the process is designed to make sure that there's a very broad group of stakeholders, there still are likely existing inequities that may be continued as part of this system. For example, in some communities, women may be summarily excluded either from education and training opportunities or even from the healthcare system itself. So we called for researchers to assess whether these circumstances apply and also come up with creative ways to make sure that those people are still given benefits. We call for an array of benefits, short-term, medium, and long-term. And although there are a wide range of those, there are a few that we really wanted to highlight. So those include dignitary benefits, many of which are actually cost-free, and that would be things like acknowledgement in presentations and publications, sharing the research results in lay terms, and even the consultative process itself. Research benefits are those that accrue to members of the research team, so that would be access to samples for other projects they're interested in, joint ownership of IP or patenting, and authorship in various publications. And finally, the types of capacity building that are provided to communities will be based on what comes out of the consultative process, but these could include training and education for budding researchers, the development of local IRBs, or maintaining laboratory supplies for future healthcare or research efforts. So, as with anything, it's really important to have concrete information on how benefits will be provided. So will funds be sent to a local institution or items be shipped directly from the research funder? And we really think you need to say who will ensure that the conditions outlined in the MTA are being met. Finally, we encourage research teams to adopt impact or outcome evaluations if at all possible. This is particularly important because frameworks of this type are new, and there's not really any data on how they benefit the research process. So we really think the information that comes out of evaluation would be helpful both for researchers and research funders. So, what have we learned today? First, we argue that there's a high potential for exploitation in international collaborative research. The existing guidelines simply aren't adequate. And that integrating a robust consultative process that's designed to create those two products, MTAs and benefit sharing agreements, would reduce this potential for exploitation. And finally, because researchers can do this on a project-by-project effort, we think it represents an easily implementable and grassroots solution for achieving at least one measure of social justice in international collaborative research. So I wanted to thank you all for listening, thank my colleagues at the Department of Bioethics who contributed to this project, and I know there's not time for questions now, but at the end, if you have any questions, feel free to ask.